It's November 10th, 2011. This is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fail-free living, advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery, say it.
Gone in a flash.
Gone in a flash indeed.
From our sick beds.
Yeah, we are both sick this week, as is everyone else that I know, and probably everyone else that Emery knows as well.
A lot of people don't know this, but Alan and I have bunk beds
yeah.
because we live together in order to further raise our synergy to new heights.
Yeah, if you're going to co-host a podcast, you got to go all the way.
Yeah, so we're sharing drinking glasses from time to time, and that's how we both end up with the same cold.
Yes. All right. Leading off this week, gone in a flash. We're saying this because Adobe has abandoned Flash on mobile devices.
Slow clap.
Now, this is just on mobile devices so far.
Hey, you know, the first domino has to fall.
Yeah.
The first domino has to fall.
So this is basically Adobe has previously released versions of Flash for Android devices, for I believe the HP touchpad, like WebOS type stuff.
And what's that BlackBerry monstrosity?
The BlackBerry playbook.
The failpad?
Yeah, the failpad.
All right.
All those devices at one point or another supported Flash and presumably still do because Adobe released this version of Flash for mobile devices or multiple versions of Flash for mobile devices.
But they've all sucked at it though, because like even Mossberg was like busting balls about this, right? Like when he was talking to the guy from Adobe, he was like, the guy, I think it was the CEO or CTO from Adobe, made some comment like, oh yeah, we have, you know, we support Flash on blah, blah, blah. And Walt Mossberg was like, yeah, but not well.
No, I mean, it's always, there's all sorts, you can find all sorts of videos out there detailing the performance of Flash on these mobile devices.
It's always been terrible.
It's not a good experience.
No, and it's terrible for the end users, and I think a lot of developers also feel like it's just been a turd. Because, I mean, they're unable to, I mean, they're hampered by performance, they're hampered by the experience. It's just...
And there's no good interaction. The interaction mechanisms that Flash accepts do not necessarily translate well into the mobile platform. I think they did some things to compensate for that, but you know, if you take your standard off-the-shelf Flash app from insert website name here, it's not going to have, you know, it's
Farmville. Well, you know, let's be honest. Like, it's Flash not, applications are like Facebook games,
right? Yeah, and it's not going to work the same on a mobile device. So, anyway, Adobe has apparently realized this. They are moving to HTML5 based solutions for mobile platforms. Including some stuff under the Adobe Air platform, I believe. But Flash is not a part of their plans for mobile devices anymore.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. So Steve Jobs basically took home this victory single-handedly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everyone is like, oh, he's crazy. He doesn't understand what's going on. Like, Flash is awesome. Everyone has to have Flash. Blah, blah, blah. Flash, flash, flash. And then meanwhile, it's like, you know, one of the biggest hazards that home users have is using that piece of garbage.
I think people didn't entirely realize what a burden Flash could be until it wasn't there at all on the iPhone and iPad. And people didn't necessarily miss it all that much. You actually gained some advantages from not having it there.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is I remember, before there was, like, you know, Flash Mobile, they had Flash Lite, which was designed for mobile devices for Nokia Series 60.
Huh.
And the only applications that I ever saw that used it were animated screensavers that sucked your battery faster than anything I've ever seen before. It was really a remarkable disaster.
Yeah. Well, I'm always amazed by even Flash Desktop, or, you know, the normal version of Flash, its ability to utilize a massive percentage of my CPU.
Yeah, yeah, or destroy your battery life, right? Like,
well, I mean, as a result, yes, yeah.
There was that. I think they had like a MacBook Air, and then they ran it for like 8 hours or something with a browser, and then they installed the Flash plugin and like did the same browsing and like cut the battery life in half or something, like just something terrible because it's like constantly like sucking on the CPU and like. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah. So so this hopefully will do good things for the mobile interactive web development environment, because if everyone starts using HTML5 and if Adobe's on board for that, then hopefully we can all standardize to HTML5, which seems to be a rather good solution for things.
Yeah. So. Yep. And I think that, there's an argument that can be made that, a lot of the things that HTML5 sought out to accomplish were things that Flash did, and I don't care. I think, that's all well and good, but it's a proprietary closed platform that sucks. And supporting something like HTML5 and using that is always going to get you a better user experience, in my opinion. Like that, and you don't have to have this reliance on one single provider. And you also get to have the benefit of things like open source applications for it. So,
and greater security, right?
Yeah. Well, you certainly have the means to, better react to threats,
right,
in that model than you do the other way. So, right. There's very few. I mean, there are open source Flash players, but they don't support the latest versions, and they're a result of reverse engineering and people trying to figure out what Flash is doing. There's one called GNU Nash, like Ganesh, and then I think there's a couple other ones too. A lot of the Linux folks are familiar with it, but people that really want to use free software and don't like buying into Adobe, they like having an open alternative, and I think HTML5 has been a better option.
Yeah. So, let's see. Speaking of vulnerabilities or software that may cause vulnerabilities, a story that may or may not go along with this story, but this came out this past week. The U.S. Justice Department is indicting Russian and Estonian hackers for infecting 4 million computers in over 100 countries.
Through
Flash is what you were speculating earlier.
Well, it's got to be some sort of a browser exploit, And I mean, I do forensics and incident response for a fairly large institution, and the vast majority of what we see are compromises in the browser through plugins like Java and Flash. And most of them can be, in most circumstances, come back to those plugins, and it's usually Flash. But apparently there were 4 million compromised systems all around the world. People, and this wasn't just a Windows problem. Mac users were also roped into this by being asked to install some sort of video codec to view porn. So apparently it's a trap. So there's this, you go to a website to look at your nudity. And apparently the internet's full of this. I had no idea that there's pornography online. Did you know about this?
Security folks didn't.
Yeah. Internet pornography. Who knew? But the Mac users were asked to install a browser, a video codec, so they could watch their porn. And so that was one option.
That is a pretty straightforward hack. I mean, if you get the person to download and install your software,
they do it all the time.
You could pretty much do whatever you want at that point.
The Mac Keeper Trojan was downloading something and installing it, and you download the package, and then you have to double click the package to open it, and then you have to click through and give it your password, and it happens.
But, at that point, it's more social engineering than actual engineering.
Well, as networks have gotten a lot bigger, probably the biggest, the shift that happened from back in the day when there were more machines on the open, big, bad internet, was that as the networks got larger and address space became an issue, because they were running out of IP addresses, what happened was people started using NAT more, network address translation. So they built these little private networks, and they'd put them behind gateway devices that translated the traffic from A to B. So you'd have this one IP address on the outside that you could share with, everybody behind that gateway device. And a lot of people think of that as a security measure. It's really not, but that's another topic for another day. But what happened, though, was that since a lot of machines became inaccessible directly, a lot of the people who are interested in compromising systems and stealing your data started targeting their attention towards things like browser exploits, email attachments, and things like that, things that traverse that firewall naturally, or that gateway or that NAT, to get to the end users and let them run their code and get popped. So that's that was kind of like the shift that started happening like in the late 90s. So it's been interesting to watch that. I mean, and it could potentially shift again. I mean, there was a story that I guess we can mention now. Comcast is doing a limited rollout of IPv6 to some of their residential cable modem customers. And I mean, people at home can use IPv6 through tunneling services and things like that. And I guess to condense it down to the smallest part would be IPv6 is a newer version of the IP protocol that you use on the internet that gives you much larger address space and could potentially be a problem, not only for like network management, as some of the tools don't understand V6 yet, but also there's some potential for things like, you know, circumventing these NATs by using tunneling protocols, like Microsoft Windows systems that use Teredo. Sometimes that can end up crossing over a NAT gateway, but hopefully everything will go smoothly. I'm sure it'll be an interesting point in the history of the internet as people start to transition that way. I'm really happy to see a big ISP start deploying it more, though. That'll be good. But yep. Back to the Estonian hackers.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry for the diversion there. But what was happening was the DNS servers that were being used by these systems were getting changed from the DNS servers that they wanted to be using, either a local one or their ISPs or, you know, the Google or OpenDNS or the old level 3 DNS relays, things like that. They were being reconfigured to use these rogue DNS servers that would then hijack the queries for known domains and then give you back an IP address other than the official one, so that they could essentially hijack your traffic, route it through one of their own servers so that they could get ad revenue and harvest financial records. And you know, anytime you'd click on something, they would end up getting a piece of that ad revenue because they're relaying it to an ad network somewhere. So there was this very large network of people, and they were making a lot of money.
Billions of dollars, apparently.
Yeah.
Which is huge, pretty business. Amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean,
seven people running this this network were able to make billions of dollars off of this.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, well, look at, like, companies like Google, for example, like how much of their revenue is derived from advertising networks. I mean, that's just one provider. That's
right.
Just one.
Yep. So, yeah, if you redirect the traffic for 4 million computers, you're doing pretty well.
You can do quite a bit of damage. Yeah, I mean, and a lot of times they end up, like, you know, botting those systems and making them attack people and things like that. But in this case, they were like, you know what? We'll just funnel their browsing traffic elsewhere and then harvest their clicks.
Yep. Yep. However, these folks did get caught.
Yeah, I got to find out a little bit more about how they actually like caught these guys.
So from what I understand, at least some of the data centers they were using were located in the United States, because there was a raid on their data centers.
Okay.
And those data centers were in the U.S., which makes me wonder whether they were operating out of the U.S. And I didn't see anything in here about extradition or anything like that. So it kind of makes me think maybe they were operating out of the U.S.
They said Russia and Estonia.
Right, but like maybe that's where they're originally from. I don't know if they...
Oh, no, I think they're still there.
You think they're still there? Okay.
Yeah, and I know, like, firsthand, I know that, I mean, there was a software piracy ring that was kind of operating with impunity certainly in Russia, and I believe there was someone from Estonia also, and they were always kind of like, you know, thought they were acting with impunity, that there's no way that they would ever be arrested for any of this because, you know, who's going to stop them? And I mean, like the FBI agent that was telling the story was like, yeah, and like I was standing in this guy's living room and he could not believe that the FBI was standing in his apartment arresting him and seizing his equipment. Like it just blew his mind. So yeah, I'm willing to bet that they were still there.
So I'm seeing here FBI officials said that they participated in arrest and execution of search warrants. Estonia has agreed to extradition of cyber criminals to the U.S. on two previous occasions.
Yeah.
So it sounds like they're fairly confident that's going to happen again. But I guess the extradition has not actually taken place yet.
Yeah, the FBI doesn't actually perform the arrest. They just ride shotgun as they execute the warrant as part of their investigation.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Anyway, it would be fairly foolish to operate out of the U.S. And also try and run one of these schemes.
Well, it's foolish to do it anyways. I mean, it's not like you can't be traced.
Right. Yep.
I mean, especially when you're operating an enterprise that large.
Yeah, I mean, billions of dollars, 4 million machines infected in 100 in over 100 countries. That's gonna turn some heads.
there's only a few banks that'll even like handle like that type of money for you, and like they're shrinking.
Right.
There's
right.
like I was reading. I think Brian Krebs. He used to write for the Post. He had an article not too long ago about. I want to say it was like there's only like 4 banks in the world that handle like all of the money for. You know, the botters and the malware writers and the people uh-huh. that sell credit card lists and things like that. There's only a couple of banks that actually do that. And in some cases, like, you know, they're complacent. Like, you know, they're kind of going along with it. In other cases, they just might not even know. But they're always in, like, they're always in Russia or Estonia or, like. And, I mean, like, there was someone picked up on, like, trafficking child pornography or something that was also from Estonia. There's, I don't know if it's for whatever reason, but they're a popular nation to do that from.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. They're the home of Skype. I don't know if that...
Are they really?
Yeah, they are. So they are... I mean, they have a presence in internet... they have a presence on the internet that is disproportionate to their presence in the real world, I think.
Yeah, it's probably true.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Again, another story about a compromise. This one a little bit less significant in numbers, but maybe
this is a breaking story too. We should play like a
should have our news theme.
Yeah, like yeah. I don't even know what I would beatbox for that.
Yeah, I used to on my very first podcast years ago. I used to have a news intro theme. Maybe I'll dig that up.
I think you should.
So anyway, this story is breaking as of 3 hours ago, so we are way on top of this. Yeah, I mean, we're on the front lines of reporting here. Steam, the game platform, both an online store for digital games as well as a sort of multiplayer matchmaking system, which is put out by the company Valve. Apparently had some accounts compromised recently. It started with the compromise of a few forum accounts, but apparently the attackers gained access to the account database, which included access to email addresses, salted passwords, purchase history, and encrypted credit card information.
Yep.
Yeah. It kind of makes you remember or kind of makes you harken back to the Sony breach, which was, I guess, earlier this year. But I mean, Valve isn't Sony. You kind of don't expect this sort of thing to happen to Valve. So it is a bit shocking.
Yeah. It's funny that you say it that way, too, because like most people would be like, oh, Sony's a big company. Of course they're doing everything they're supposed to do and everything that they can. And it sounds like maybe the tone that you were using suggesting that Valve was better equipped.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Valve has fewer people, but... each one of those people is significantly more aware and capable to respond to issues of security in their infrastructure.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, while maybe they don't have the raw number of people devoted to fixing their security, the people that are devoted to it probably care a lot more about it and put a lot more effort into it. And there are... they're, you know, probably across the company. I mean, from what I know of Valve, people kind of work on what they want to work on, and everybody kind of has a sense for what everyone else is working on. So there's sure. probably a good number of people throughout the company that are aware of all of the security protocols, and among those people, the people who are actually working on the security protocols probably really care about the security protocols because they're working on them by choice, not by that sure. is their dictated job.
And I think, you know, the gaming industry had a really good example with the Sony PlayStation Network thing. I think they were all kind of like, well, this potentially could have been us. So we got to make sure that we're taking precautions. So from what we're seeing in the news, though, it would certainly be worth changing your password. And if you use the same password for your Steam account that you do for other things, that would be not only a bad practice, but also a good opportunity for you to go out immediately and change them all. But I think that from what we're seeing in the news, it sounds like this is kind of the best case scenario for a total compromise like this, in that the email addresses may have been, you know, pulled, but the passwords and the credit card information looks to be well protected. Like, even though they have it, they have it in an encrypted form.
Right, and this was not entirely the case in the Sony incident, right?
Yeah, it's my understanding, and you know, again, I don't have like the details in front of me or anything, but I read a couple of reports that hinted that some of the information from the Sony database was not protected as well, and that even though it was encrypted, it was not using a strong enough hashing algorithm. So there's a variety of ways that you can encrypt data that makes it harder and harder computationally to break. So while, yes, you can take something that's encrypted and you can try to crack that encryption, there's a couple of things that can make that more difficult and much more expensive and time-consuming for somebody. So odds are good that it would take, you know, your credit card will probably expire before someone would be able to decrypt the number. Does right. that make any sense?
Yeah, sure.
So I think that's probably, and that's if the reports that we're seeing are accurate. And so we still don't even know. It's like, what is it, 3 hours old?
Yeah. I mean, so what's happened so far is there was this initial report of forum accounts being compromised. And then apparently Gabe Newell, who's the CEO at Valve, wrote like an IM or something. And an instant message from Gabe Newell.
But it like went out to everybody. It's like a broadcast to all Steam users, right?
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, yeah. Okay. Because I thought there was like an IM to some news reporter or something.
No, I don't think he had like, you know, his assistant like typing it out to everyone's okay. Yahoo Messenger.
I mean, I have been logged into Steam. I mean, I am constantly logged into Steam because my desktop is. And I have not gotten the message yet. So I'm not sure.
They have more than like a dozen users. I mean, maybe it's taken a while.
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, crap. What is it? It took like Sony, I think, like a week to send out the emails to everybody because they had that, like, they said, like, you know, we started the batch and you know, like, you know, they have their one lone SMTP relay over there at Sony cranking away
now. To be fair, the initial forum breach was on Sunday, November 6th, so there has been some time elapsed between then and now. When the sort of full details as known by Valve are being released. But it seems like this is probably happening as soon as they knew what the full details were. So, but it, you know, it's a little shocking because, you know, Valve is a company that I generally trust.
They're well respected and well regarded. I don't think anyone has a lot of bad things to say about Valve.
No. I mean, they put out a good product and good games. They tend to demonstrate rather robust engineering practices within those products. They actually made a big show earlier this year about being really secure about Steam logins. They implemented this whole two-factor authentication scheme where if you're logging in from a new computer or logging in from a new location, the Steam client actually prompts you for sends a key to your email and then asks you to type in that key to make sure that you are actually you. So they clearly put some effort into engineering the security of this platform. So it is a bit shocking to see a breach like this on that platform. Definitely.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a common problem. It sounds like a database attack of some sort. So against some sort of web application on their forums that was able to traverse
more than
their backend and find other database instances, which could indicate like a possible architecture problem there, but something that I'm sure they're sorting out. I mean, I do know a employee there, and I mean, not well, but they're one of the smarter people I know. So I have every confidence that they're on the ball.
Yeah.
Not a lot of dummies under that roof, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you see, are you going to get Skyrim tomorrow?
I'm getting Skyrim tonight at 9:01 p.m.
You are such a nerd. I love it.
I lent a friend my camera for a trip that he was going on, and in exchange he gifted me a pre-order for Skyrim. So
nice.
So I am all pre-ordered up. I actually pre-loaded the game earlier today.
Oh wow!
So you can preload it where it downloads the whole game to your hard drive, but it's encrypted. You need an unlock key to decrypt it. So at 9:01 p.m. tonight, I'll get that unlock key and be able to start playing.
That is really cool. That's a good practice. I like that.
Yeah. Again, solid engineering practices over there at Valve.
I finally got into a the distributor. I thought it was Origin or
no. I mean, I guess you might be able to buy this in other places. You can certainly buy a hard copy of it, but for the PC, sure. I mean, I'm going to buy it on Steam if it's available on Steam, definitely.
Well, now more than ever, I think.
I know that my account there is so secure,
now you can get it for free because you'll just call your credit card company and be like, I have no idea what the Skyrim thing is.
Yeah,
that's terrible. Don't do that. There was a. Gosh, what was the other thing, too? I guess this week also had...
This week was crazy for games. What's that? Call of Duty? Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3, which no one should care about.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there was a game released 2 years ago called Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2.
Yeah.
This is that game.
There was also... what was the other thing?
There was Uncharted 2 was released.
That's right.
Yep, was released. I think actually last week, like on Thursday, maybe.
Uncharted 3 that was out?
Uncharted 3. Yes.
Uncharted 2 is the one that I'm supposed to play.
You're supposed to. Yeah. Well, you're supposed to play Uncharted 2, and then Uncharted 3. But
Uncharted, really?
Well, okay, you can start with 2.
Really? Is the first one good, or is it like? Because
I haven't actually played the first one, but I've heard it's good, but nowhere near as good as 2. So.
Well, I'll play 2 then.
But as I said on a previous show, you could probably, I mean, so many copies of 2 were sold, and it's mostly a single player game. You could probably get used copies for super cheap.
That's all I play.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So there's Skyrim this week. There's, I believe, Saints Row 3 or Saints Row the Third comes out this week as well.
The Third.
All right. And then there's, I mean, it's, you know, we're entering the holiday season, so it's all sorts of crazy stuff. The new Legend of Zelda game's coming out soon.
Oh,
yeah. Batman Arkham City came out a couple weeks ago, is coming out for PC in a few weeks.
I gotta see what that new Zelda game looks like. Because, you know what really ticks me off, though? There's two games that are great, in my opinion. All right, there's actually a lot of games that are great, but. The Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker for the GameCube.
Yeah, sure.
Amazing.
Sure.
And that was probably my favorite one ever. And I really wish they would go back to that cel-shaded, playful style.
So they did for some of the portable games. If you buy a Zelda game for a DS, then it's got that style.
And I love that. And that was so much fun. And I thought that was a really great game. And I did not like the one for the Wii, mainly because I couldn't get past like one of the first dungeons because I'm a big idiot. But the other thing was I just didn't like how it looked. I couldn't get into it. I was just like, yeah, okay.
Sure. Yeah. Too dark.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good... Yeah. That's a, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Well, it was called Twilight Princess, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Anyway, Skyward Sword, actually, some early stuff has been leaking here and there about that game. And apparently... some people are saying it is extraordinary. Like it is game changing. If that is,
I'm surprised it's coming out for the Wii.
Enough expression. It's Nintendo, so they're going to make their game for the Wii.
Well, no. I thought they were going to hold this off for the next console. One.
Yeah. No, I mean it'll be probably the last big game for the Wii.
Yeah, I was actually like really expecting them to delay this into the next gen.
No, I mean it's been too long coming at this point. You know, it's been years since the last one. So, the Wii needs a picker upper right about now. You know,
that's true.
They need a anyone who hasn't gotten a Wii yet should go out and get a Wii to play this. You know, they need a everyone take your Wii out of the closet one last time and play this game.
I've got it. Yeah, I've ever told you like my problem with my Wii.
I don't know if I want to.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is something I want to hear.
the optical drive on my Wii is super terribly noisy, and it's like out of warranty, and it's like a big pain in the ass. So I actually did a soft mod just so I could pull my game discs onto a USB hard drive because it seriously drives me bananas. Like it's like it's like this terrible screeching sound.
Yeah.
So I gotta. Yeah. That's like the, and it was actually bad enough that I didn't even play the Wii for like 6 months, like 9 months maybe.
Wow.
It was terrible.
Huh. Anyway, but apparently there's some very special things going on in that game. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what that's all about.
Heard of this this bookstore?
Bookstore. Oh, yeah.
This
you know,
Barnes, this Barnes and, so this, Barnes and Noble.
Yeah, this story came up and apparently Amazon's got this new competitor called Barnes and Noble. And
Barnes and Nobles, as people call it. Have you ever heard
I mean,
that?
They must have come out of nowhere, because, I mean...
The Barnes and Noble.
So there's all sorts of stories this week about Barnes and Noble taking on Amazon once again.
Yeah. Let me run
through this first, and then we can break this down.
Okay.
But the idea here is, so Amazon released the Kindle Fire. It hasn't released it yet, but they announced the Kindle Fire, and it'll be out very soon.
Like next week, or?
I think next week, yeah.
You know, one of our potential future guests, I think, just had an email that said he already has one. Hold on.
Oh, wow.
One second.
The Kindle Fire, though, is you know, this 7-inch tablet meant to sort of distribute video and rich book content and all this stuff. Through Amazon's infrastructure to this tablet, and costs $199, which
and video.
I said video. Costs $199, which is a pretty low price point for a tablet. So now Barnes & Noble, who has previously made the Nook devices, reading devices, which ostensibly compete with the Kindle devices.
It's worth pointing out, sorry, but the Nook was an Android device also.
Yes, yeah. Also, it's worth pointing out as a side note, I was talking with a friend at MIT today, and he was saying, I mean, it was bizarre how it happened, but he was running this like network experiment. He works on a lot of low level network stuff, and he needed another client. So he actually rooted his Kindle just to use it as like a Wi-Fi client. And he says, there's a full Linux install under that thing. Like, he was running Linux utilities. That, you know, that he was amazed were even on there. You know, it's got wgit you can run, you can, you know.
Well, you can get that stuff on like an iPad. Like, if you jailbreak an iPod,
with a Kindle, I mean, you don't.
Sure. Okay.
I guess because the screen is so sluggish, like, you just don't really expect there to be, you know, a Linux install running behind that thing. Anyway, on topic here. So Barnes & Noble now, to compete with this Kindle Fire that was announced, they are now announcing a new 7-inch version of the Nook. They've had a Nook Color device out for a while, but this is a 7-inch Nook Color positioned directly in competition with the Kindle Fire. However, it costs $50 more, so it costs $249. Although
is it Wi-Fi only? Or?
I believe it is, yes, at least for the time being, maybe. I know that that's the case with the Kindle Fire, and I don't believe other Nooks have previous Nooks had 3G?
I don't think so.
I don't think they have.
No, I think you've had to like sideload content onto them also, I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
But it's got it's got double the storage of the Kindle Fire, so 16 gigabytes instead of 8, and it has a longer quoted battery life for those extra $50, presumably.
Yeah.
So, I mean... My whole, and I wrote this in the show notes, my whole issue with this, and probably your issue with it too, is like, since when is Barnes & Noble a consumer electronics company?
Well, since the Nook. I mean, they've had the Nook.
Right. I mean, you could make the argument that, like, since when is Amazon a consumer electronics company? You know,
that's true.
That typically are an online retail company, you know, but, like, I mean, Amazon was at least close to the space. I mean, they were, like... They were still working in the technology industry, you know? Barnes & Noble was nowhere close.
Yeah, and there's also the issue where Barnes & Noble does not have nearly the same infrastructure. They don't, you know...
I mean, they're not a tech company.
No, they're a retail outlet, yeah.
Yeah. They're a retail outlet that sells, you know, paper books.
You know, they're only, in my opinion... I think that the only chance that the Nook really has is if they do something like embrace open formats or, you know, to do something to
differentiate themselves.
Yeah, because, I mean, I cannot look at the Nook and buying books from Barnes & Noble and treat it the same as Amazon.
Yep.
I mean, there's in my assessment as a consumer is that Amazon is a bigger and more significant player, and investing in that platform is a smarter move as a consumer because it's more likely to be there in 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what Barnes and Noble's. I have no idea what they're even doing. I mean, like, Borders just shut, you know, they shuttered in the last year. You know, how committed is Barnes & Noble to the Nook, and are they really going to double down on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Barnes & Noble has to be committed.
And how is it
point.
Any better? And how is it any better than the Kindle or an iPad? Like, but, I don't think.
Yeah,
it is.
I mean, I think they're you know, the differentiating features were like lending books was one. But now the Kindle has this whole lending library thing.
Amazon Prime on the Kindle Fire.
What's that?
And you get if you have Amazon Prime and a Kindle Fire, you can watch videos and TV shows and all that. Like, can you do that on the new Nook?
I think you get they have like Hulu and Netflix, but I think you may have to subscribe separately. So
yeah, I'm sure you do.
Yep.
And then the Hulu subscription is the dumbest thing in the marketplace right now.
I think like, we've gone over this.
I'm going to pay these idiots $9 a month to watch ads.
Yep. Anyway, so you know, that's just a little odd to me. I mean, the Nook, the original Nook, actually, I think differentiated itself partially just because it kind of, you know, it had some like it looked pretty good, right? I mean, it didn't function that well, but
it had a better display. It had the color display, which people were like, "Ooh, the color display!" And it had that cool little like that browse panel at the bottom. It had a pretty nice.
The browse panel at the bottom was actually largely unresponsive. But the fact that it was there gave it some differentiating, you know, it differentiated it a bit.
Oh, yeah, please. I mean, it's not like I ever used one. I walked past them at Best Buy or whatever.
Right.
But I think people have bought the Nook in order to root it and run, you know, a custom Android.
But Amazon has outright said you can root the Kindle Fire.
Yep.
So, yep. And $50 cheaper. I mean, you know, yeah, maybe if double the storage is
here's the deal.
Extremely important to you.
Here's the differentiation.
Okay, differentiator.
All right, here we go.
Lay it on me.
So with the Kindle, you're using Amazon stuff. You've got if you've got Prime, you can do things through Prime. If you've got you know, the Amazon Music stuff, you go through Amazon Music. The Nook lets you use Pandora.
Oh.
Netflix, Hulu. So what Barnes & Noble strategy is this. We will partner with other content providers.
Yeah.
And we'll do the books because we think we know the books. We got the books handled. And what they're going to do is try to incorporate other services that have brand recognitions. Because right now, you could be in a position where you get a Kindle and you're like, oh, I have Pandora. I'd like to use Pandora. And then you're like, oh, I can't. But I'm pretty sure
Pandora's got to be available on the Amazon App Store, right?
I would hope so. I'm just throwing it out there as an example. I think I mean, is Hulu though? I don't know.
But
I mean,
that maybe that's the different approach that they are taking to.
They're
going to
use. They'll let other brands and other services use their platform for delivery, and they're going to insert themselves in the middle there. Right. So that's their difference.
Okay.
Yep. So how, I don't know. Do I care about that? No.
Right. Exactly. all right. So speaking of other things that Barnes & Noble will not be able to sell.
well, yeah. So we don't really know this yet, but apparently the music industry might be canceling the CD.
Yeah. So this is a story that you pointed me to, and
there's uncredited sources in the music industry.
It's a little shaky. Yeah, this is not the strongest story out there, but it's kind of amusing. So why not?
Yeah.
So there's this report that inside industry sources in the music industry say that major record labels are planning to ditch compact discs entirely by the end of 2012.
That's not too far away, Alan.
No, it's really not.
Yeah, and well, I mean, the CD has had a very long run so far.
The CD has done pretty well for itself as a storage medium.
And it still makes a ton of money. Like this guy from Billboard, Glenn Peoples, he does not think that the CD is going anywhere.
Yes.
Like he's the dissenting voice on this story is that it's a huge source of revenue for them. And while the music industry has been like, you know, having a total meltdown over the last 10 years over, oh, gosh, these people are stealing music and blah, blah, blah. And we don't want to move to digital, you know, online distribution and whatever. But
this guy says record labels have shown no desire to ditch the CD. The format still accounts for most sales revenue, and labels have been able to encourage the development of new digital business models while enjoying, not relying on, the considerable revenue CD sales provide.
Yeah, I like the idea of being able to buy a CD.
Yeah.
I like having the, I mean, it's not the original source, but you know what I mean? Like, I,
You like having a physical copy.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't bought a CD in years. But
you like, in principle, you like to potentially have the ability to possess a physical copy.
Yes. And if I wanted something, well, I mean, what I buy these days, I buy stuff on iTunes and I buy vinyl.
Okay. I buy stuff on Amazon MP3.
I should probably look into that.
It's great. I mean, you download the files and they're already MP3s. You don't even have to convert them.
Well, I don't care about it. You know, I don't mind AAC at all. I don't like protected AAC. Anything that's not DRM, I'm fine with.
Yeah.
Because I use other devices. I don't like having it locked into one platform. And that's why I liked having a CD option. So, I mean, we still have, like, our household, we probably have, like, God, I don't even want to know, like, 700 some odd albums on CD.
Right.
And they're all, like, you know, in a box. Because once we encoded them all, they got filed away.
Yep.
So, you know, if worst case scenario happens, like, we have to re-encode them all, which is going to be horribly tedious. Oh, no, I guess not, because iTunes Match is coming out. iTunes Match will save me. But, yeah, I think, I mean, the CDs, you know, I think it's probably dumb to keep making them. But, I mean, there's people that prefer them. And I think there's people, I mean, there's going to be that core constituency that complains that digital music is not good enough. You know, they can tell the difference in the encoding.
To be fair, CDs are actually digital.
Yeah.
It is whatever, 320 kilobyte per second on those
higher
CDs.
Higher than that, isn't it?
Is it higher than that? Okay.
It's got to be.
Let me see. CD bit rate.
Because, I mean...
Okay, yeah. So if it's an audio CD, which the type of CD you'd buy would be... Then it's at 1411.2 kilobit per second.
Yeah.
So that is uncompressed. But
it's substantially higher resolution audio than you would get by buying an MP3 or an AAC file.
Yes. However, human hearing cannot distinguish above 192 kilobit per second.
So you say.
And so current scientific literature says, but just in case that changes... I rip all of my music to 256.
I usually do too. But the other thing is, not necessarily, in my opinion, it's not that I can tell the difference between, what is it, like 128 and 256 and 384 or whatever. Like,
it's that your robot dog of the future may be able to.
No, it's actually that it's the, sometimes the encoding process itself creates artifacts in the sound. So even though, like, I don't really know what I'm really trying to explain, but there is something to be said for encoding the file from its original source into something else and it not being perfect.
Right. Yeah.
So even though you can't tell the difference in the two files when they're done, like the source will be,
anytime you compress something,
you introduce that loss. Yeah.
Right.
Any compression always introduces loss. And so even though you can't tell the difference, it's entirely possible for you to be still missing stuff. That's just no longer there.
Yeah. There's a video out there where have you seen this? Where the guy compresses a JPEG like thousands of times.
No, that's awesome. You
know, yeah, he takes a JPEG image and just saves it, same exact quality, same resolution, all this stuff, but just saves it over and over again, exports it to JPEG, you know, and it just gradually degrades in quality to the point where it is completely indistinguishable. Like, you cannot tell that it came from the source image at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Oh, I saw there's a follow-up story to the Flash thing for mobile devices. Apparently, this is also going to impact televisions, like smart TVs.
Oh.
Because they're dropping support for that, too.
Huh.
So, like, there are some people that were doing, like, Flash applications for televisions, which sounds like probably the dumbest idea in the world. But
is this all centered around Hulu or something?
I have no idea. But it looks like Adobe is kind of adopting, you know, Steve Jobs' vision on apps as being the preferred channel or mechanism for distribution of content rather than relying on things like a plugin like that. That's kind of an interesting thing. But yeah, there's a story connected TVs. It's kind of interesting.
Huh.
Yeah, GigaOhm has a story about that.
Is it too soon to theorize that the death was a cover-up? He's now working at Adobe?
Yeah, he's in the mailroom.
Yeah. subtle influence over there, apparently.
Yeah.
All right. And closing out the show today, the main topic of today.
Main topic?
I'm maybe overselling this a bit, but I'm actually pretty excited to hear about this.
Yeah, I built a new computer.
So you've got a new computer. I believe we detailed the parts on a previous episode, but yeah. I thought maybe you wanted to run us through sort of the process of getting this thing together, and then your end result of how it has changed your computing environment.
If you are thinking about building your own computer, there is one critical thing that you should be mindful of, and that is, buy a modular power supply.
Yes.
Oh. I didn't even know these things existed.
Yeah. Fairly recent development. I think it was, it's the past few years or so that they've really become popular.
Now, what this means is that you can now buy a power supply for your computer that has, like the cables, the power stuff, they'll be like detachable. So you don't have to have all of the cables active. You could just plug in the stuff that you want to plug in. That's awesome. And if you're me, you don't buy that, and you have what looks like the severed head of Medusa sitting at the bottom of your computer.
Yep.
I have probably, I bought an 800-watt power supply. I have 6 hard drives in that machine, and I have, half a dozen cables that aren't even hooked up to anything. It's, waving around. So I have this really horrible situation there, but I've got it all kind of, tied up, and I think it's not, banging into things or causing a problem, but it's definitely not what I would call tidy. I bought the same case as you, but mine is a silver one, so I have the Fractal Design R3 with USB 3 ports.
It is a wonderful case. Oh, mine does not have USB 3, USB 3 in the back, but not the front.
Oh, you can buy a new front panel. Do you see that on their website?
Yeah,
go to their website.
I'm not going to use front-facing USB 3 ports.
All right, you say so. Right. But yeah, so the board that I got is a Gigabyte UD something or other. So that basically means it has onboard video. It's a Sandy Bridge chipset. Yep. I bought an i7.
i7.
2600K, so it's unlocked. So
that is the same as mine, yep.
I can overclock that bad boy. Mm-hmm. I did buy a CPU cooler, but I have to send it back because it didn't fit.
Huh.
I was clicking around on Newegg, and I saw one, and it said, compatible with the i5 and i7, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, all right, cool. I clicked that, put it in. And then it was for a different type of motherboard. It wasn't for the 1155. It was for the, 1156.
Huh. Okay.
Which has a different layout. So I'm using the stock cooler, so I'm not doing any, I'm not overclocking it or anything. But, it was actually pretty straightforward. I haven't built a computer like this since quite a while ago. I mean, I did put together, I bought a bare bones shuttle, couple of years ago. And kind of bought current tech there. This time I reached out a little bit. I wanted to get something that was going to last me a little bit longer. Mainly because I wanted to just avoid having to invest in it for the next couple of years. Mm. So with that, I also bought a video card that I really liked. It's the Radeon. It's an ATI Radeon 6870.
Wow, you went ATI.
Yeah, it's not bleeding edge by any stretch. It's like a year old card.
Yeah.
But it was it wasn't too expensive. It was $150 and it screams for what I do with it. My video needs are very limited. The only game I play is World of Warcraft on the computer. And although I did get accepted into the Knights of the Old Republic beta weekend thing.
Wow.
But they don't have a Mac client, so I installed it in VMware on Windows 7, and we're going to see how that goes this weekend.
Okay.
So look forward to my head desk on next week's show. But I'm kind of curious because, to be honest, this machine hauls ass, and I've been kind of wondering how well the 3D support for Windows through VMware is these days. It's supposed to be pretty decent. There's people that play Eve and stuff because they do botting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know people that bought Eve in virtual machines, so I figure it can't be horrible, but it's not going to be great.
Presumably you've got plenty of hard drive space. Why not do a dual boot?
I thought about that, but I like having the machine available, and I also like having it's not the only VM I run, I've got other stuff I do with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have kind of one... Oh, yeah. So the memory I bought was nothing special, but I got a lot of it. And then the drives I just transplanted for the most part.
I'd be careful of that. I mean, I'm sure you know, but like,
what?
I mean, if you keep transplanting drives from computer to computer, eventually those drives are going to fail.
Well, they're going to fail anyways.
Yeah.
So here's what I got, though.
Okay.
I have my SSD that I moved over, and then I reinstalled the OS.
Okay, well, that's not going to fail. But
well, you say that now. But
yeah.
We just put like a... We had an SSD die in less than a month.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But,
I mean, but 10 hard drives are going to fail before the SSD fails.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, ideally. But but I'm also using ZFS, and I'll get into that some other time.
Oh, like, okay.
I have really awesome storage.
You have a fancy, fancy setup. Yeah.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do have two 1 terabyte drives that are mirrored in a ZFS pool, and then I have a pair of 500s, and then what is that, 2, 4? And then I have the SSD, and then I have I bought a Blu-ray recorder. You know, you can get those for like $100.
Oh, no way! Yeah, I mean, I thought about it, and then it's like, well, yeah, but a thing that reads and writes every type of CD and DVD imaginable is $12. So
that's true too. But, yeah, I was thinking to myself, though, and I'm like, you know, it's not like I really think I'm going to burn a lot of Blu-ray stuff. Like, I don't really make anything that big, and if I burn video that I'm working on, like an iMovie and stuff, like a DVD is going to be huge for it. And, you know, heaven forbid, a dual-layer DVD, you know?
Yeah.
But I was wondering, and, like, I was thinking maybe, like, long-term backup stuff, like, maybe it wouldn't be bad. Because, I mean, like, a Blu-ray holds, like, 50 gigs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and to be fair, you're probably better off just getting like a USB hard drive and backing up to that. It'd be faster. But I don't know. Like long-term storage, I'm like, well, maybe. I don't know. $100, why not?
Yeah, and so, you could potentially use it to play Blu-rays, although I know there's some copy protection issues there.
Ugh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even want to get into that because I'm sure it's a huge pain in the neck. I know people do it, but if you... So the other trick here is that I'm not running Windows on this machine. So I built this machine using parts that would let me install OS X on it. And this is not something that I'd really recommend that a lot of people do because it's a lot like having a race car. If you ever see like someone that has like a classic car and they're like really they're the only person that knows how to drive it because there's a lot of like little quirks and like little things you got to do and be mindful of. It's a lot like that. There's a lot of things that it's really good at, and one of them being you can build a very, very fast machine for not a lot of money. Like my total outlay was like, you know, $1,000. And you can't get that kind of machine from Apple. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely not for the faint of heart, but you can do it. I'm not going to say that it's not possible, but I wouldn't recommend it for a lot of people. If you wanted to be like a real hobbyist with it, it's not a bad way to go. But it's nowhere near as nice an experience, in my opinion, as buying an actual Mac from Apple. So I wouldn't, like I said, I mean, I wouldn't steer anybody towards it unless they were new what they were in for. But it works pretty well. I've got a couple of issues. One is that the USB, this is the other thing too, right? Is that I don't know. It could be any number of things that are causing this, but I have a USB 3 drive, and after a lot of use, so like if I'm like doing a big rsync job and I'm like pushing a bunch of stuff around because that's been happening a lot lately as I'm rearranging data, sometimes the device will just unceremoniously vanish from the USB bus and eject. And then I go into Disk Utility and it doesn't show up. I can pull the cable out. Sorry for the pop there. I can pull the cable out and then plug it back in and it'll come back. The FireWire 400 port will see that I have a FireWire drive attached to it, but it will not actually see a volume on that device.
Wait, so where are you getting USB 3.0 drivers for Mac OS X, though?
Let's see. There is a...
Really?
Yeah, there's a kernel extension that you can get from a vendor who supports a USB 3 card for
Mac that you could put into like a PCI slot on a Mac Pro or something?
Yep.
Oh, wow. Huh.
So there is support for it, and when it's on, like it's fast. And I'm also having a weird networking issue that I'm not entirely convinced is because of the fact that I'm using some open source Ethernet driver, as much as I think it's actually caused by VMware.
Okay.
There's something weird that VMware does when it opens a network interface to bridge your VM onto your local network. And I'm not sure what that could be, but there's some weirdness there. So like sometimes my VMs and my machine will just fall off the network, right? So one way to like resolve that is to down the interface and then bring it back up, and then it's fine until it does it again. But I also went out to like Best Buy and I just bought a PCI Ethernet card and plugged that guy in, and then but it's not quite the same. So I'm still ironing out a few kinks.
This sounds like such a pleasant computing experience.
Yeah, see, this is what I'm saying. It's when it's working really well. But it's not something, I mean, I'm sure there's probably, I mean, also remember that I have like some really weird crap hooked up to this thing. Like I've got my Logitech G13. I've got a slew of bizarro world devices. Like I've got two mice, a Bluetooth adapter, keyboards. I've got a Logitech webcam. I've got this USB hard drive, a FireWire drive. There's a whole metric ton of miscellaneous peripherals that I have plugged into this thing. So I'm not entirely convinced that, you know, it's a problem one way or the other, but right. I think to be fair, I think that my USB hub is probably contributing to some of this.
Okay.
Oh, and then, I don't know, but there's a lot of people that share their experiences with this, and there's a lot of resources out there, online that I won't point to, but, but if you are someone that, is curious, I mean, you can always write us or whatever and I'll aim you somewhere, but, it's been interesting. It's definitely made me very familiar with OS X internals in a way that I otherwise wouldn't, for better or for worse. You know, like I've had to learn a little bit about how kernel extensions work in OS X, the boot process, a couple other things. There's all sorts of interesting things that go on there, but it performs very, very well in terms of like just raw output. I believe when I did like just a Geekbench, you know, it performs twice as well as the machine that I replaced.
Wow.
Yeah. Like in the span of, you know, a year and a half, 2 years, the computational power is effectively doubled for me.
That makes sense. Yeah. I mean, that's, that is computing for you.
Yep. And so, you know, that just kind of gives me pause too. I'm like,
yeah.
Like, what's going to happen in 2 years? It's going to be something crazy.
You get to spend another $1,000.
I don't know about that.
All right. Well, I mean, you can always take a second graphics card and throw it in that thing.
That's true. Yeah. You can't run like SLI for OS X, though.
Crossfire. Right.
I mean, you can have two discrete graphics cards in there, and I do have room for it, but they don't benefit from those technologies.
Then you'd have to actually run Windows.
But I could, however, use the onboard if I wanted to also. Like,
right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
OS X has some provision for switching between integrated and discrete graphics cards, but I guess that's for their laptops.
Yeah, and if I want, I mean, I run my workstation has two displays on it. I run them both off of the ATI card, but I could run one of them off of the onboard because my Gigabyte motherboard, I've got a DisplayPort, HDMI, and DVI.
Okay. Huh.
So I think I can run three displays off of the integrated Intel video if I wanted to.
Wow.
Yeah, because I think there's somebody on one of the forums for the hacks has a forehead machine that he's built.
That's impressive.
I know he's using two of those through the integrated Intel video.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah. It's been pretty good though. But I'm also I've been running the Z for 10, which is a I'm in a program testing that. It's like an implementation of the ZFS for Mac OS X.
Uh-huh.
And if people that aren't familiar with this, it's basically a file system. Like on Windows you have NTFS. And most Mac people use HFS Plus. And then there's other ones out there, but the one that I'm talking about is called ZFS, or the Zettabyte file system, and it has a lot of benefits for data integrity. So it lets you do things like specify every time you write a file. Well, first of all, you can easily create disk arrays and multi-disk raids through this software, and then you can also do things like say keep two copies of every file that I write to this array.
Hmm. Wow.
So then if something actually, like if the file gets corrupt or a block on the disk gets corrupt, it can also kind of self-heal and say, Last time I tried to read this file, I noticed that it had degraded in some way, and it will replace itself with the copy. So, for example, if I keep my iTunes library in a ZFS pool, I can say, everything in my iTunes library, you're going to keep three copies of it. And you can do additional compression, and you can deduplicate. So if you have like more than, if I, for some reason, have the same thing in there twice, it'll only take up space once. But since I'm also retaining multiple copies, it's, you know.
So you are way ahead of the failing hard drive issue.
I am super, super ahead of the failing hard drive issue. I can lose a disk on each pool and not care. I could go with more redundancy. I mean, you can create, I could take 12 disks and create a pool out of that. So if you had like 12 1 terabyte disks, you'd be able to lose.
You'd be able to buy a new computer for the amount of money that you would.
Well, I don't know. Cause, you know, you can get like those 2 terabyte Western Digitals for like $99.
I don't know. Did you hear about the Taiwan of, what was it, flooding?
What? Is that why the prices are raising?
Yeah.
I went on Amazon the other day and I was going to buy a new hard drive and I was like, man, what's going on? I went to Best Buy. They're cheaper.
Yep. So I'm just pulled up the news stories. Thailand accounts for 45% of worldwide hard drive production.
Yeah.
And the flooding has damaged more than a dozen hard drive disk factories.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not a good sign.
No. It's like overnight, prices for hard drives went up by like $100.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. I was looking around, just like, this doesn't look right. Like, I didn't even know that.
Yep.
That explains a lot. But yeah, I think, if you have like a dozen disks, though, in a pool like that, you can lose, I want to say, something like 6 of the disks could go bad before you even lose data.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. I hope that, when the product is released, we'll probably be talking about it quite a bit more. Yep. I think it's fantastic.
This discussion leads well into a preview, possibly, of what may happen next week on the Hell Yeah Show.
Yeah, we want to talk about storage, in particular for home networks, which I think will be a really fun topic. So, and we might even have a guest.
We may indeed. It'll be our first special guest if it happens. So
yeah,
that'll be quite cool.
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. You can contact us at show@hellyeah.com. Send us all of your angry emails. You can visit us at show.hellyeah.com or
on the Twitter machine, twitter.com/hellyeahshow.
That's right. Okay, other than that, next week we may have a special storage show for you, hopefully.
That'd be great.
But other than that, we will see you next week.
Have a good weekend.